This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 178 was recorded August 1st, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is brought to you by TopTradersOnPlug.com, the only podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, which I highly recommend. Bloomberg Markets Live blog chief Mark Cudmore joins me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss global and U.S. growth trends, why Mark has turned bearish on the stock market, bond yield outlook, commodities, and much more. Be sure to stay tuned, though, for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when former Dallas Fed insider Danielle DiMartino Booth joins us for extended FOMC coverage.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, let's talk about this roller coaster ride in the markets. Now, before we even get to the S&P 500, let's start with the bigger picture review of the major events that happened this week.
Well, Patrick, we had two really big market events this week, one widely anticipated, one not anticipated. So let's start with the widely anticipated event, obviously, was the FOMC statement, which came out on Wednesday afternoon. Now, it was already widely expected that they would cut 25 basis points. That's exactly what they did. No surprise there whatsoever. The thing is, most people were thinking of this as the beginning of a new rate cutting cycle. And Jay Powell went out of his way in the press conference to describe it as a mid-cycle adjustment, implying that it's not the beginning of a new cycle. It's an adjustment in what perhaps is still a continuing rate hiking cycle. That's what spooked the market, and we got a nosedive in stock prices, much lower, very briefly touching that 29.60 or so level, very, very briefly, and then quickly bouncing back up to almost 3,000 level before the session was over. And then over the course of the day on Thursday, it seemed like we were almost completely retraced, well back above 3,000. Everything's looking good. And then came the unexpected event, which was President Trump tweeting that they're going to effectively add a 10% tariff on the remaining $300 billion of goods and services coming from China into the United States. So restarting the trade war effectively. And that caused a much more dramatic sell-off in markets on Thursday afternoon after President Trump's tweet.
Well, let's move on to that S&P 500 to really kind of get what a roller coaster ride again. Like the S&P 500 starts off with the first reaction of Powell was comments just with a dump to the downside. We were almost down to 29.50 on the downside. Then suddenly a huge morning rally. And then came the Trump tweet, and we were basically as high as just around 3,010. And then we find ourselves just wiping out 50, 60 S&P points in a span of a couple hours. What's going on here?
Patrick, it is no surprise to me whatsoever that the knee-jerk reaction down in reaction to the FOMC statement had retraced almost completely less than 24 hours after it had happened. That didn't surprise me at all. So I thought we were frankly headed back toward new all-time highs. Now, in the past, President Trump making statements or tweets or whatever that seem to restart trade wars have had a much more severe and longer lasting impact on markets. So what's happened is we've come down now to the point where as we're still about 15 minutes before the close, as we're recording this segment, we are just barely teetering right on 29.60 on the S&P. That is Nomura's number for where they believe if we see a daily close below 29.60, it could beget more selling from algorithmic traders, CTAs particularly, who trade on algorithmic models. So it's going to be really interesting to see what happens next. I think what's probably going on here, big picture, is President Trump is looking for the setup to say, okay, he's got things like the trade war, which he's probably wanted to do for a long time, but you know, he didn't want to crash the stock market coming into election season. Well, this, I think, he saw as an opportunity if he's going to take policy action like tariffs on China, that he was going to do it right after the FOMC meeting so that he could blame any market reaction on the FOMC rather than his own policy actions. So I think that's probably what motivated the timing here. In any case, it's going to be very interesting to see whether we bounce back from this or if it starts another wave down. Think about the last time we had a re-escalation of trade wars. It led to, what, a couple hundred points down in the S&P into that Christmas event. So anything's possible here.
All right, Eric, let's move on to the U.S. dollar.
Well, Patrick, what we saw was a very clear break above 98, the exact event that we've been waiting for on this program, and we've talked about quite a bit. And that came in reaction to the Fed using language to portray their rate cut, which was expected, as not being the beginning of a new rate cutting cycle. We saw it really take off today before President's tweet. We were at, I think it was 98 spot 60 or something, really just taking off to the upside. And I think that by itself, that was the indication to me that we were headed towards 104 on the dollar index. It's the breakout we've been waiting for. I thought this was coming. But you know what? When we saw that tweet, it caused everything to bounce back. And I don't think that this action around trade policy is really going to make a big difference. I think the retracement that we saw was a buying opportunity, and I bought more dollar index futures on the dip this afternoon. But the thing is, Patrick, don't underestimate that outlier possibility of President Trump acting independently from the Fed. The president actually tweeted a news interview, a video interview, where a commentator was describing a desire to end the Federal Reserve, abolish the Federal Reserve and not have it anymore. Why is the president tweeting that? Is he just angry, or is he actually trying to signal an intention to really take things into his own hands and work around the Federal Reserve? That would definitely completely destroy my whole dollar bullish theory if President Trump were to directly intervene in FX markets and try to circumvent or undermine the Federal Reserve's independence by taking monetary policy into his own hands. That could cause a major loss of confidence globally. I think it would be a very bad thing for the country, but it's not out of the realm of possibility. Barring that, I think we move much higher on the dollar from here, but that would be the risk.
Well, let's talk crude oil, because that's where the biggest move has been. We're down about 7-8% right now. What's your thinking here on crude?
Well, let's start with the EIA inventory numbers. Crude oil drew down 8.5 million barrels. That's a massive, massive drawdown against analyst expectations of about a 2.5 million barrel drawdown. So massive miss there. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 1.5 million barrels. And finished products, also drawdowns across the board. Gasoline, down 1.8 million barrels. Distillates, down 894,000 barrels. Obviously, that would normally be a super bullish fundamental indication for crude oil prices. The tape reaction was an instantaneous pop up in prices, but it didn't last. It only lasted a couple of minutes. We closed down on the day. U.S. production was back up to 12.2 million barrels. That was a huge difference from last week. So it confirmed that last week was really just a hurricane anomaly. The thing that's really interesting, though, imports 6.7 million barrels. Exports were 2.6, only 18 million barrels on the week. So where did that 8.5 million barrels go? If production was back up to 12.2 million barrels, so there's no shortfall there, and exports are only 2.6 million barrels, which is not a big number for exports compared to recent history, then what caused the drawdown? Where did that oil go? We talked about this in some detail in Energy Week. So for anybody who's interested, listen to yesterday's Energy Week episode for more discussion on that topic. In any event, the market already looked pretty weak this afternoon, Patrick. Before President Trump's tweet came out, it looked like we were going to have a daily close below the short-term moving averages, which might signal the beginning of a new downtrend. But it was kind of close. Then came President Trump's tweet, and suddenly I think crude oil got hit harder than anything else. It was down more than 8% at one point during the day. I think by the close it was 7-point-something%. Massive, massive down day, and it's going to be very interesting to see how this whole trade war thing plays out. But I don't think it's that trade wars are that much more impacting on oil than other markets. I think it was oil was ready for a catalyst to take it lower.
What's your thinking here on gold? I mean, that rebounded pretty quickly here after selling on Powell's comments.
Let's start with the roller coaster of the last 2 days and then zoom back out to the big picture. Gold was looking great before the FOMC press statement came out, and it seemed as if what was happening was we had the resolution to the symmetrical triangle pattern, short-term symmetrical triangle. It had broken up, it came back down, it touched that trend line as support a couple of times, and it was starting to gradually move higher. Everything looked great. Then came the FOMC, and all of a sudden, it really looked to me like gold was getting ready to tank on the much, much higher breakout on the U.S. dollar. So we see the U.S. dollar index breaking out above 98, very quickly moving through 98.50. Looks like we were headed toward 99, might have even gotten there today. And all of a sudden, the Trump tweet comes out and that reversed everything. That caused gold to be upwards of $35 in just a couple of minutes. And that's a combination of geopolitical risk as well as the downside to the dollar. The real question, I think, is what happens next with the dollar? Let's assume that I'm right about the dollar and we don't see President Trump really take things into his own hands and circumvent the Federal Reserve as the nation's central bank, as we talked about earlier. Let's assume that does not happen and the dollar moves much higher. Then we need to get out to the big picture of possibilities. If we see the dollar move higher and gold move lower, it's a really big question in my mind. I think that for sure, if the dollar moves much higher aggressively, as I think it will if President Trump doesn't stop that from happening, we could see lots and lots of downside. But frankly, I won't be surprised if it just is the catalyst to get us back down to a retest of the breakout zone around 1350 to 1377, and then further upside from there. The other possibility is that gold just keeps on going up from here, and we've moved into that regime that we've been predicting for years on this program, which is we eventually get to gold and the U.S. dollar moving up together at the same time. Now, that sounds like great cause for celebration for traders, but frankly, that's a sign of things getting really scary. It means that there is a double safety trade going on where people are moving into U.S. dollars and into gold as safe haven assets, and it means that faith in the global economic system is deteriorating. So if we're already moving into that regime that I didn't think we were ready for yet, it really makes me concerned about how other things are going. It's going to be very, very interesting to watch this correlation between gold and the dollar in coming weeks. I'm going to have Brent Johnson back on an All-Stars appearance next week to talk about this very issue.
All right, let's talk those 10-year Treasury yields because we are now decisively below 2%. What's going on?
Well, you know, we came back down to 201 on the Fed news, and this morning we'd actually bounced very decisively. I think it was 205, 206, and it seemed like maybe we were headed higher in yield. Needless to say, President Trump's tweet was utterly devastating. We're actually looking at one spot 89, just coming into the close at 4 o'clock on Thursday afternoon. So, holy cow, I guess I missed the opportunity. I was hoping to buy the dip. I thought we'd get back up to maybe a 2.20 yield or something, and if that had happened, I would have been buying. I missed the boat on that one, and it'll be interesting to see how much this continues and how far the trade war situation escalates from here.
Okay, well, thanks for the update. Now, before we move on to this week's feature interview with Mark Cudmore, we're pleased to announce that we'll be releasing a second feature interview this week with another guest. Eric, what led to this development?
Well, you know, I was talking to Dr. Pippa Malmgren when we recorded her All-Stars episode that aired last Friday. She, of course, lives in London now with her daughter. And her dad, Hal Malmgren, who lives in the United States normally, walked into the room at the end of the thing and said, hi. And suddenly we just had this opportunity and impromptu, we recorded a double interview with both Dr. Harold Malmgren, Pippa's father, and Pippa Malmgren. So the setting here is the 14-year-old is cooking dinner. We have Hal Malmgren, who was an advisor to four U.S. presidents. That was Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Ford. And Dr. Pippa Malmgren, of course, has been an advisor to two U.S. presidents. I kind of channeled my internal Jesse Felder and took a completely different approach. Instead of talking about markets, I got to ask Hal Malmgren how it feels as a father to both have been a presidential advisor himself versus watching his daughter follow in his footsteps. And what was that experience like to see his daughter become a presidential advisor as well? Something I don't think anybody else in history has ever been able to say, that they advised multiple presidents and then their daughter went on to advise multiple U.S. presidents. So it was a very, very interesting interview. We didn't know what to do with it because it made a great full-length feature interview for a Thursday night Macro Voices podcast. And we've just got a really full schedule already with fantastic guests right through Labor Day. So when I told our sponsor, Niels Kastrup Larsen, over at Top Traders Unplugged about this, he said, look, if it's more PIPA, I'll sponsor it. And so we're going to air this as a Hot Topics episode, which we're going to bring you on Sunday this weekend. So look forward to that in your Macro Voices feed. And my thanks go out to our friends at Top Traders Unplugged for stepping up and making it possible. I also want to take this opportunity to announce that we are now welcoming ad agencies to represent us. We really appreciate the listeners who've tried to help put us in touch with their companies who might make sponsors. We still want you to do that if you can help us in that regard, but it hasn't led to enough leads to really get the sponsorship we need to make all of our Macro Voices content free for listeners indefinitely. So we do welcome ad agencies to contact us. We're paying 15%, not 50. We were born at night, but not last night, guys. But please reach out to us at info@macrovoices.com if you want to talk about representing us on a non-exclusive basis.
All right. Well, thanks for the update, Eric. Now, this week's featured interview guest is Bloomberg's Mark Cudmore. Now, Eric, why did we invite Mark back to the show this week?
Well, Patrick, Mark heads up the Bloomberg Markets Live blog, which is only available to people who have the Bloomberg Terminal service. So it's basically just institutional investors. But it's a very, very highly respected blog, and he's got a lot of perspective. Mark was a just steadfast bull last time we talked to him. I think it was close to 18 months ago in the program. He turned secularly bearish this spring. And I wanted to get his perspective as to what's changed his mind and his outlook on markets generally. So I think it was a great interview. It was taped before the FOMC statement, so we don't have the benefit of knowing about the roller coaster ride that was coming, but it's still an excellent perspective on markets generally. And this episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. You often hear me say on the program that even if I have conviction about a market or trade, you have to listen to what the market is telling you, not what you think it should be doing, but what it is doing. And that's exactly what trend-following managers have been doing for decades with great success. These are rules-based strategies that remove human emotions and therefore can be well-researched and tested. And there's one podcast that covers trend-following strategies better than any other. TopTradersUnplugged.com. And right now, Macro Voices listeners can even get a free book called The Many Flavors of Trend Following, explaining exactly how these systematic strategies can work for you. Just go to TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro to claim your free copy. Again, that's TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro. Check them out. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Mark Cudmore is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at MacroVoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Mark Cudmore, the global managing editor for Bloomberg's Markets Live blog. Mark, it's great to have you back on. I'm going to have to apologize to you because the last time we had you on, we recorded your interview on an FOMC week before the FOMC meeting, so we didn't have the benefit of knowing the outcome. We learned a lesson and we promised ourselves we would never do that again. And it's you that we did it to again. So I apologize, and I'll ask our listeners to understand that Mark and I don't know, because we taped this ahead of time, what the outcome will be from the FOMC. But let's go ahead and dive in and start with the global growth outlook for the global economy. My view is that we're seeing awfully strong slowing signs, but a lot of people have different views. What's the big picture? How do you see this economy?
I'm completely with you. And I think actually what's important to emphasize is that I'm not really sure that it matters too much that we're recording this before the Fed this week. I think that I do share your slightly more worried picture around the global growth outlook. I think that this is already set to be, well, we know it's already set to be the slowest growth in 3 years, but I think that the growth outlook will actually turn much worse towards the second half of the year. And I don't think that the Fed, no matter what they do, is going to change the story that much. Ultimately, we know from history that the Fed is a very poor ability to kind of change the economic cycle. They can kind of change the timing, alter it, but they can't stop a recession when it comes. And I think it's important to emphasize that the last two recessions that we saw in this century, we did see rate cuts come before the recession, but they didn't stop the recession coming. So in September 2007, they cut by 25 basis points. Recession still started in December that year. And in January 2001, the Fed cut by 50 basis points. The recession still came starting in March that year. And I think in both those cycles, the Fed had more than 500 basis points to cut. In fact, they did cut at least 500 basis points in both economic cycles, for both easing cycles. And yet it didn't stop the recession. Obviously, the Fed doesn't have that kind of ammo this time. And the transmission mechanism is even more impaired after years of QE. So the Fed was already poor at turning the economic cycle around even before QE, even when it had lots of ammo. Now it has neither the ammo and the transmission mechanism is broken. So I think that the global growth outlook is looking quite worrying. You know, we last spoke in April 2018, so 17 months ago. It's actually interesting to note that JP Morgan's Global Manufacturing Index has declined in every single month since then, which is quite a good track record. And the preliminary PMIs from July almost guarantee will be in contraction for the third consecutive month when those numbers are released, I think the day this podcast will be published. So the collapse in global trade is really kind of impairing things, and I think that's kind of very important at the moment. You just, as a summary of this situation, there's so many different metrics to look at this collapse in global trade. I don't think anyone disputes it. You can do clever things like look at FedEx earnings or any kind of number of indicators. To me, I like looking at two of the kind of the world's best broad indicators, and that's Germany, which accounts for roughly 12% of global trade, and Singapore, the trade hub for Asia. So Germany 2019 GDP forecast has collapsed from 1.9% this day a year ago to 0.7% now. So it's quite an extraordinary kind of downgrade. And all the risks remain to the downside. The most recent IFO Business Expectations Index has dropped to the worst level in a decade. And at least, you know, a decade ago, it was on the way back up. Now it's actually on the way back down. It was on the way back up in the crisis back then. But we're going back into another crisis, I think, but a more minor crisis. The most recent manufacturing PMI at 43.1 in Germany suggests a recession is likely coming there, or it's certainly a high risk. And the manufacturing PMI has actually been in contraction territory all year. So Germany is not only the most important economy in Europe, but it's also so dependent on trade. So it's a great broad measure. And it looks like it's heading for a recession. So I struggle to overlook that signal. And especially when that's combined with what's happening in Singapore, where I live, electronic exports, most recent reading, have seen a more than 30% annualized decline. And that's for two consecutive months. We've not actually seen that kind of drawdown since the crisis again. It's quite incredible. And, it, you know, Singapore's such an open economy. It really captures what's going on in Asia. So I think that both the trade hub in Asia and the trade hub in Europe are kind of showing this collapse. Now, there's not the same kind of trade hub which matches up quite so well in North America, because U.S. is a little bit more closed economy, but Mexico is the closest. And as we know, the Mexican economy is in absolute dire straits as well. So I think we're getting a very kind of consistent message there. You know, just to emphasize this, like the high frequency data is showing that this kind of slowdown we've seen is ongoing. So the advance estimate, for example, for 2Q GDP in Singapore came in at minus 3.4% versus plus 0.5% expected. That's the worst quarterly reading since 2012. But all the high frequency data like retail sales, industrial output, and PMIs suggest that contraction is ongoing. So there's clear problems for all the big trade indicators. I'm very worried about global growth. That's primarily based on a manufacturing and trade situation. And so the outlook is definitely more negative than it's been for many, many years for me.
Now, Mark, I think the story on global growth, I mean, it's undeniable. It blows my mind that anybody could disagree. But in the case of U.S. growth, I'm also thinking the U.S. is not immune. Some people seem to think the U.S. is somehow not going to be subject to all the same forces that everybody else is feeling. What's your take on U.S. growth?
So it's interesting you say that because, like, obviously there's these scary signs to the world's best trade indicators, and then you combine that with the message that we're getting from manufacturing. And I think that the optimism around the U.S. is actually particularly misplaced. It's not that suddenly the U.S. is going to have the worst growth in the world. It's that it's there that people are most in denial about what's happening, and I think not looking possibly ahead to how some of these indicators are going to play out. And they're taking a very optimistic kind of outlook. I like applying Occam's razor, which is, you know, make the least number of assumptions as possible. And I think many people's optimism is based on a number of things which don't look likely. One is, of course, the US-China trade war being resolved. And I think that's kind of particularly misplaced. So, you know, as I mentioned, the trade, the manufacturing is a problem, but for the US, particularly as the decline in the CapEx in the US will probably accelerate by the end of the third quarter, just as the lagged impact of May's tariffs hit. So we saw that last year that the tariffs kind of came in the summer, but we really saw the economic impact towards the kind of fourth quarter. And I think this year we've again seen the tariffs about a month or so earlier, and we'll probably see them towards the end of the third quarter is when we'll start seeing the economic impact. And that's because there's like a little bit of front loading and there's just kind of delay in kind of adjusting business supply chains, etc. Also, the guidance from US corporates in the past 2 weeks has made clear that third quarter is likely to see earnings shrink for the first time probably since December 2015. Which we seem to be ignoring because 2Q earnings are holding up okay, even though most of them came before the tariffs were in place. So companies are going to get hit directly on the profit side, just as the economy is getting hit. And that's going to be a double whammy on CapEx to kind of help accelerate the end of the cycle. And I do think that this is very much contingent, I will say. Like my bearish outlook, I don't think matters too much on the Fed meeting this week and the guidance, as I mentioned. But it does matter a lot on the US-China trade war. I don't see a resolution coming anytime soon in that. And I think if I'm very wrong in that, if we do get a resolution which removes all tariffs, and I think it's important to emphasize the resolution needs to remove tariffs, not just call a peace. If we don't get something that removes tariffs, then I think the situation will be much worse. And I think it's important to emphasize that the view on the trade war. Well, speaking in the US, I was in New York a few weeks ago talking to a lot of investors, and the view on the trade war in Asia is very divergent. In the US, it's very much seen that it's entirely Trump's decision and that Trump will want a deal with China before the election in 2020, therefore to boost the economy. And therefore, because that will suit him, ultimately there will be a deal. I think the view in Asia is that since May, that's massively changed. Up until May, that was true. China wanted a deal as well. They were really downplaying the trade war domestically, and they were kind of happy to kind of make some kind of peace with Trump, especially since they're going through their domestic deleveraging campaign. But what's actually happened since May is that the narrative onshore has completely changed. So rather than like ignoring the trade war, kind of downplaying it, they've actually hyped it up quite a bit in the domestic press, and they now no longer can be seen to not get a win out of this. I mean, there's been reference back to the Opium War treaties of the mid-19th century, so going back 150 years, which kind of shows the timescale they're thinking of. They're not thinking on election cycles. They don't need to think of election cycles. So, you know, Xi Jinping seems to have given the message quite clearly from the Standing Committee of the Politburo, you know, you must get a win out of this in some way. So obviously there's many ways that both sides can sell whatever agreement as a win. And I realize that's a situation that can be fudged, but it's not that neither side can be seen to concede completely. Certainly Trump has bipartisan support for a hard line on China and the US, even if maybe not his exact tactics. So it's not something, and he's made it such a big part of his campaign that he's taking a hard line there. It's not something that he's going to concede probably completely on. And I think likewise, China, while they might be able to, you know, convey the message in a certain way domestically, again, they cannot concede completely. So I think a deal is going to be very hard on US-China. And Trump even said this recently, that China may want to wait till after the election. I do think that, you know, there's been some slightly better data in the US recently, but I do think that the focus is on the wrong thing. So people keep on pointing to unemployment as proof that the US economy is doing wonderfully and the Fed shouldn't be cutting rates. I find this completely bizarre because kind of one of the things you learn very early on in economics is that unemployment is a lagging indicator. And I think it's worth kind of pointing to what happened in the last three recessions as an example. So in 2007, unemployment had only risen from the 4.4% cycle low to 5% before the recession started. unemployment obviously peaked at 10% in that cycle. So most of the pain came after the recession. Again, in 2001, unemployment had only risen from 3.8% to 4.3% before the recession started. It peaked at 6.3%. In 1990, unemployment had risen from 5% to 5.5% pre-recession. It peaked at 7.8%. So generally, there's been about a 0.5% climb in unemployment from cycle low before the recession officially starts. Of course, we don't get confirmation that the recession has started until many months later. So that will kind of tally with the recession starting around when unemployment hits 4.1% in this cycle. I mean, that's easily possible by end of this year, early next, which is when I think that we may get close enough to a recession starting in the US, probably maybe in December, January type period. Obviously, these things are very hard to predict very exactly, but that's kind of my rough base case. And I should emphasize that, you know, there's a chance we might avoid a technical recession of two quarters of negative growth, but I do think it'll be close enough to a recession in terms of a severe impact on markets, which is what I care about most.
Well, let's move on to what you care about most then and talk about markets. Why don't we start specifically with U.S. equities?
Yeah, sure. So I think this is probably where I've got the most interesting view. I think, you know, when I've been on with you before, I've been on in a good period and for markets and a bad period. And both times I've kind of really emphasized that I've been a deep structural bull for many, many years. I can't actually remember the last time I was a structural bear in U.S. equities, but it was at least 2011. I did stay too bearish after the last cycle. I can't remember when I finally learned my lesson of what QE was doing to the system. But now for the first time since at least 2011, I'm a structural bear on U.S. equities. I think the timing of that decline is hard, but I guess I'd phrase it that up until now for the last many years, you know, I've had periods of being tactically bullish, tactically bearish, but I've always been in the mindset of ultimately you're buying the dip. It's just a change of how low you buy the dip. And I think it's now the mindset of now I think ultimately you're kind of selling the rally, but exactly where you sell the rally, I don't know. And that's what I'm trying to work out. I do think that the sell-off starts imminently, you know, but I would have said that to you a month ago and obviously been wrong because we're at record highs. But I think it starts by kind of September latest, maybe October at the very latest. But really, I'd be surprised if it hasn't started by September, because by then we'll kind of have the bad data from August, which is when the tariff impact will really starting to hit properly. And it'll also, in my theory, be likely clear by then that US and China aren't removing tariffs soon. And then what happens is we'll see economic forecasts get slashed, and then we'll see earnings forecasts get slashed. So we're seeing the earnings guidance come a lot lower over this earnings season already, but I think that we'll see Wall Street really react to the fact that the economic forecasts are getting slashed everywhere. So the S&P 500 is trading at 17.2 times blended forward earnings, 12-month forward earnings. That's versus the 10-year average of 15. Now, if it's very expensive, there's a massive premium. Now, we all know that these things can stay expensive for a long period of time, but it just means that it's vulnerable if the narrative changes. Corporates are healthy. They've got like a good profit margin, and that makes it particularly hard to call a top. But I just will emphasize that the narrative can turn very quickly. If just one part of that jigsaw changes, people will go, whoa, suddenly that price looks weird. And I think that if you look at that forward P of 17.2, if the denominator gets cut, their earnings get cut, which we're seeing, we're starting to see, and we'll see that happen more from Wall Street in the next couple of months, then even without a price change, they start looking more and more expensive. So, you know, ultimately, we're probably going to see need price to come down a lot to make that P look normal. And then it'll probably overshoot, as it always does in these situations. Importantly, that impressive margin story is starting to be unwound at the margin, to excuse the pun. We're seeing estimates revised down for the third quarter, fourth quarter, and first quarter of 2020. But bizarrely, we still expect an impressive rebound in 2020. Why is that? Well, the index estimates for 2020 are based on steady revenue gains and strong improvement in cyclical sectors such as technology and industrials. I find that very bizarre given that what we're seeing on the trade front and the economy front, it could be true, but it does look like at the moment that those index estimates for 2020 of double-digit kind of gains in earnings again are just wildly optimistic, and I just don't see what narrative they're based on. Actually, I can probably say what narrative they're based on. They're based on that US and China will definitely have a grand deal which kind of accelerates trade by early next year, and that is the narrative they're based on, and that the Fed's expected easing, however much they do in the next few months, will kind of success actually re-stimulate the economy like the late 90s kind of insurance cycles in 96, 98. I think it's bizarre that everyone seems to have convinced themselves that the Fed cut this time will be just like the insurance cuts of 96, 98. It's clearly possible. I find it bizarre that's the base case, given that the two most recent easing cycles, as I said, didn't stop deep recessions and didn't stop both in the coordinating with the recession in the early 2000s and the one in 2007, 2008. Both times, the S&P lost more than 50%. I'm not sure we're going to get quite that big a dip this time, but something to be aware of.
Well, Mark, I couldn't possibly agree with you more that U.S. equities are overvalued here, overpriced at these levels. But I've thought that for more than a year, and that hasn't caused the market to give up. And so I'd like to kind of play devil's advocate and run a couple of thoughts by you. One of the reasons is I struggle to figure out how the heck we got back to all-time highs. Okay, you know, if you look at just the mechanics of what's been driving this market, it seems that corporate buybacks have played a huge role. And hey, if we're going to see treasury yields continue to move lower, meaning cheaper, easier money for buying back your stock, that potentially propels the market higher. There's also a view that a couple of our guests, Brent Johnson in particular, has expressed, which is, you know, things are going to get so bad for Europe and other parts of the world, and they're already at negative yielding treasuries. So their safety trade can't really be into treasuries, as is the usual deal. They've got to look for something else, and maybe U.S. equities end up benefiting from an international safety trade, and that propels the market higher. Now, I don't mean to suggest that I think the market should go higher, but since it hasn't been doing what I think it should be doing for quite a while now, what do you think about those scenarios as potentially frustrating our mutual view that the market ought to be moving lower?
Great questions. And actually, I love these kind of questions, because obviously all the time what I want to do is kind of find out what I'm missing. So I think I'll just say the context, and I'm not trying to be annoying to you, that I was staunchly a structural bull until May this year. And I think for me, I always believed that we'd keep on going back to record highs. And I was very dismissive of previous concerns. And I think it's important to emphasize that backdrop, just because I'm going to explain what's changed. So for me, what kind of drove the rally before then were three pillars I used to refer to them. And that was growth, earnings, and liquidity. So like economic growth, earnings, good earnings, and liquidity in the system. Now, you've talked about the corporate buybacks been a really important part of the story. And I think that kind of comes into the liquidity thing. I'm probably going to come to that last, because that's probably the most nuanced. So I think, first of all, one of the pillars is that global growth has been kind of subdued, but absolutely fine for years. And as I explained kind of in the first part, I do think that kind of global growth picture is going to get severely downgraded, largely because of this trade war and just because we're at the end of the kind of economic cycle, and then that CapEx deceleration. So I think that growth is one pillar that's about to be taken out by the end of this year. The second pillar is now earnings. Now, we've come off an incredible earnings period. You know, both internally in companies, we're making a lot of structural changes, and then just technology help. But then, of course, we had the stimulus that came through in the US, the tax cuts. So we've had a massive boost in earnings. And again, as I said, the earnings picture is changing very drastically. It turned out we didn't quite get, I think, negative earnings in first quarter this year, and I think second quarter we're going to be again slightly positive, but they're still massively down in the last couple of years. So already the earnings outlook is less positive, but it's not been taken out yet. Now, the estimates show that third quarter is likely to be, as I said, the first negative earnings quarter for the S&P 500 since December 2015. So suddenly that's a second pillar taken out. So two of the pillars have been taken out. Now, the third one is liquidity. There's clearly abundant liquidity in the system, and you know, central banks are still overall pumping a lot of cash into the system. One of the favorite things I love pointing out, it doesn't matter too much about quantitative tightening. We discussed this actually a year and a half ago, that you know, the Fed is only the fourth most relevant central bank in the world when it comes to providing liquidity. The ECB, the PBOC, and the BOJ all have balance sheets around 5.3 trillion roughly, whereas the Fed's balance sheet is now around 3.8 trillion. So like, they're just like, oh, you know, they're 30% or nearly 30% bigger than the Fed. Each of them is nearly 30% bigger than the Fed. So I think that overall we've got a lot of liquidity in the system. But it's interesting, if you take their combined balance sheets, the peak in central bank balance sheets was actually in March 2018. So I think that's quite interesting to note. So we had a whole decade going up to March 2018 where central bank balance sheets just kept on growing, and they kept on pumping more liquidity into the system. So that was something that suddenly changed. So the fire hose liquidity has been turned off. It's not coming massively lower, but it is a bit lower. Importantly, PBOC, probably the most relevant one, did peak out in March 2018. But the PBOC, ECB, and Fed all have smaller balance sheets today than they did then in dollar terms. The BOJ is the only one that's increased. So liquidity has suddenly stopped being pumped into the system. And as because we know it's very important in markets. It's the kind of second derivative. It's the rate of change. It's not necessarily the nominal level that matters so much. But I also think that the liquidity situation around corporate buybacks in particular can change very rapidly. So one of the things, the structural things that's happened in the market since the crisis amid the regulation is that liquidity in the credit market is incredibly impaired. And this is not a novel idea. Many people have warned about this. Many of the biggest credit buyers have warned this. Many of the biggest issuers have warned this. So, you know, Bank of America, I believe they're some of the biggest kind of issuers of leveraged finance. And they've kind of warned about the liquidity in the system. PIMCO, for example, have warned about it. So, you know, many of these big names have warned that there's a liquidity problem there. And that's because banks can no longer be the middleman to kind of step in and provide a break in the system when things go wrong. So the reason I kind of explain all this is credit's obviously pricing very tightly at the moment. There's this hunt for yield, et cetera. But that situation can change much more rapidly than it could 10, 12 years ago. I mean, the last crisis was a credit crisis. I was working in Lehman Brothers at the time, so I kind of saw it from a front row seat. And yet the liquidity couldn't disappear as quickly as it can now. So I think that as I said, the three pillars that were driving the rally. And that's why I've been a kind of structural bull for many years. And suddenly, I think in the fourth quarter of this year, we're going to have the growth pillar taken out. We're going to have the earnings pillar taken out in the third quarter. And I think that the third pillar of liquidity is no longer as dominant and strong as it once was. And it can actually quickly turn negative in practical purposes for companies if we get a bit more of a negative view. So if the credit cycle starts turning, it could turn much more negative very quickly. And I think that's where you get your little bit of a mini financial crisis. And I should emphasize, I'm not calling for a repeat of the great financial crisis or the global financial crisis of 2008, but just like a bit more risk-averse environment. So I think that that's kind of the point I'd emphasize. And I think the final point you made is a good one, is that, like, you know, hey, if the whole world's in a bad place, where do you put money? I mean, do you keep on putting it into European negative yields? I think that, as I said, if the credit cycle turns, there's a lot of leverage in the system. So suddenly that kind of, actually a lot of it just happens in deleveraging. Suddenly people start cutting down. There's less need for this money to find a home if we do get that kind of credit blow up, which kind of causes deleveraging. So I think that's the first point to emphasize, that you can just get this wealth destruction like we see in every recession, like we see in every crisis. This is, again, not a particularly novel idea, but because we haven't seen one in more than 10 years, people can't always think about it or remember it. So we just get that generally de-wealthing effect. But I also say that, you know, one of, I guess, my central theories is that, you know, US has outperformed for the last 4 or 5 years for many valid reasons. And I think that era of outperformance in the US is coming to an end, or is at an end, essentially. And I think that, obviously, US is still the world's largest economy. So if it goes through a bad period, everywhere is going to suffer. But I think that it's unlikely to pick up as quickly afterwards. And I think that there's many markets in the world, probably more in kind of in emerging markets, that will suffer that kind of initial pain when the US kind of catches a cold, but they won't kind of suffer such prolonged pain, and where there's much better opportunities. And I think you talk about where can you put money, there's not always the liquidity, but, you know, many emerging markets do offer much higher real yields, are structurally much safer, they're much less deleveraged. Many of them do not have the external vulnerabilities they did have a few years ago. The currencies are super cheap. I mean, these are just incredible fundamental stories longer term. Of course, emerging markets are higher beta. So if US equity market suddenly is going to sell off, you know, 20% plus in the next year, then obviously emerging markets are going to have periods of pain, but it won't be lasting pain. There'll be opportunities there. And I think that's what you'll see. You'll see money coming out of the US equities and looking for opportunities elsewhere in the world.
I want to just push back a little bit on your final pillar of liquidity. We had a view from Danielle DiMartino Booth, a former Fed insider, earlier this week on Macro Voices. And she said, look, the thing to watch for at this FOMC is what everybody does is they shift gears from everybody's anticipating the meeting to focusing on what's going to come next. And she said, the question you have to ask is this is going to be the Fed's, assuming that you and I both have the same assumption, which is by the time our listeners hear this interview, there will have been a 25 basis point cut. That will be the first Fed rate cut in more than a decade. Is that the opening shot in what becomes essentially a currency war that's going to cause all the other central banks to pile in and say, no, we're going to ease just as much. We're not going to let you get ahead of us. And you potentially get into a competitive devaluation kind of situation. Are we headed in that direction, or could we be?
In theory, yes. In practice, I think, A, those rate cuts are already priced almost everywhere. And most of the rest of the world, they can't go much lower. So, you know, we've gone from a situation in November last year where almost every central bank in the world was pricing hikes ahead, and quite a lot of hikes. And now we're suddenly in a world where, in fact, every central bank is pricing cuts. And some of them are ahead of the curve. Look, we've already got, you know, Bank RBA has already cut rates a couple of times. And, you know, it's already pricing in rates getting to 0.5%. And ECB is pricing even more deeply negative rates. Same for S&P. Bank of Japan is somehow, you know, pricing in the idea of more easing. I mean, it seems frankly unbelievable these countries that are already negative, deeply negative, are pricing in more easing. So they can't do much more. And importantly, they can't do loads more than it's priced. And I think this is one of the most important things about the Fed, about, again, you know, having been so positive earlier on this year. And like when January, when the Fed turned dovish and people were like, oh my God, what does that say about the economy? And I was like, hey, wait a sec. They surprised dovishly. This is only a good thing for equities. This should see equities roar in the next few months. The difference is now is it's hard for them to have that kind of dovish surprise impact. We're already pricing in the Fed, you know, making 2.5 rate cuts by year end. Yes, they still have a little bit of extra ammo to deliver more. Like we need to price in the fact that they, you know, they're going to cut probably 200 basis points in this cycle, ultimately 225 basis points in the cycle. So there's more to kind of price in, but it's not easy. It's suddenly changed. Look, if only a few months ago that we were pricing in rate hikes, and then it was very easy to surprise. Now that the two-year kind of the shift in the two-year yields has just been frankly incredible. And so I think that in theory, it's right. Like it, the Fed will cut 25 basis points and then, you know, other central banks will soon follow, or some of them have actually got ahead. It's not even following. This is a general theme. And I don't necessarily like the idea of currency war. These are people enacting monetary policy. And yes, currency is one side effect of that. I'm not sure they're directly targeting the currency. But there's only so much they can do, and most of what they can do is priced. So yeah, there's a little bit of positive support to come in on that front over the next year or so. But I think if we get to a world where we're pricing in the Fed cutting the full, you know, 225 basis points to get back to 25 basis points upper bound, then in that world, we're already in a super negative world. We only get into that world when equities have already sold off 25%. So I don't think that kind of negates the view, no.
Let's move on to treasuries. You know, a lot of smart people thought once you go past 3.10, it's all over, secular bear market in treasuries. And of course, we've seen the opposite. What has been the primary driver in your mind of this reversal, and does it have farther to go?
So treasuries have got a mixed one for you. So like I don't have super strong short-term views of these levels. I think it's very hard at these levels. I think it's one where, you know, last time, every time I'm going to go on this podcast, I'm not shy on my views. I'm going to get some things right, some things wrong. And the treasuries one is one I got right last time in terms that I said to you, whereas in April last year, and I said that I said I did not believe in the bond bear market at all. I was not believing that risk at all. And I think, you know, it was a big theme at the time because yields were just touching towards 3% for the first time in years. And everyone was kind of going, this is it. And many people had called for the start of the big bond bear market. And my theory at the time was that just because we're ending the 30-year bond bull market doesn't mean we need to go into the next long-term bond bear market. And the reason I'm repeating this is because the views haven't changed. So at the time, I said, look, I thought the top end of the range for 10-year treasuries would probably be about 3.2%. I think in November, 6 months later or 7 months later after our podcast, it eventually reached 3.24%. But that was around the top. And my whole argument at the time was, A, we have structural disinflation, which I just think is completely underestimated, both from technology, not just through the Amazon effect, but also just because the extraction, production, and distribution of commodities is continuously getting much cheaper. And that's also the main input for prices. And obviously, we have the demographic effect. So we've had massive asset price inflation, but that does not feed through to the necessarily consumer price inflation basket. So I think that people are understanding those structural disinflationary impacts on consumer price inflation. And therefore, I did not see inflation being a threat. And therefore, I did not believe that we're going to see kind of treasury yields go too high. And especially because last year when we spoke, I didn't know that March 2018 was going to be the peak of central bank balance sheets. So I was very much in the camp last April that, you know, there's just endless liquidity in the system and it's still being added. And it's just as long as all that liquidity in the system, they're going to continue to buy yields and they get too high. So that kind of worked out in the past. And I'm emphasizing that because at this point now, I'm struggling to have these kind of views. I do actually believe that 10-year yields ultimately are going to have lower to go. The other view I kind of had last year was that we'd see further flattening in the curve. And we've now had that flattening. We're now close to kind of inversion in the two-year, 10-year bit. Many other parts of the curves have inverted. And I think we'll we'll probably see a little bit further flattening at some point. And I do think that 10-year yields ultimately have lower to go. The problem is, as you know, close to 2% at the moment. Where's the next 25 basis points? I really have no clue. And, you know, my bias as a trader is kind of go, whoa, they've come a long way very fast in one direction, maybe a little bit of a bounce. But again, I would have said that a little while ago, and we haven't really seen much of it yet. So I don't have any conviction about where the next 25, 30 basis points is. But I do think that 10-year yields around here completely make sense. It's not illogical at all. And this has always been my long-term view. And I think they'll probably continue to come lower. I think you do not see yields in the US sell off. I mean, something I've written many times last year is I never see 10-year yields in the US getting kind of above 4% basically ever again until you have like a US dollar currency crisis, which might happen at some point in the future, but I don't see it as close. So to me, I just don't believe the arguments into a bond bear market. I think we're in a massively wide range, and that's the status quo for many years. Because I currently have for the first time in many years, I have a much more bearish view on the global economy and US equities, I do think that those 10-year yields will kind of test much lower again next year at some point, but the exact path is hard.
You mentioned the dollar. Let's get your views on the US dollar.
I remain a kind of secular dollar bear. So I was looking last time for 2018, I was looking for a powerful dollar bounce in the second half of the year, which we got. And I said at the time it wouldn't be a move to fresh highs. But again, I turned bearish. And basically, we've had that big, powerful bounce at the end of last year. And I'm now expecting the next kind of 10% move in the dollar will be for weakness. Again, though, the timing is super hard. And in very short term, especially given that I don't think the Fed that's going to come out just before this podcast is going to be overly dovish. I think even short term, there might be a very little bit of kind of upward pressure again first. But as I mentioned earlier, I think the era of US outperformance is at an end. I think that Trump's attitudes towards trade and his more isolationist approach is forcing other countries to try bypassing the US as much as possible and companies. This is not easy because it's the world's largest economy, and it's something that people are very reluctant to do. But because he's kept up this isolationist approach for a couple of years, more and more companies are just going to try having their supply chains just bypass the US. So it's going to become increasingly less relevant. It'll remain dominant, but its dominance will decline. I think Trump's currency intervention threat will help cap the top side. I know it's not expected he's going to come in anytime soon, but if you suddenly see euro dollar down at 1.05, or you see dollar yuan up through 710, suddenly that might be escalated. So I think that helps cap the top side for the dollar. I think as I mentioned, the US actually has much more room to cut rates. So the rate of change in the US will be more drastic than elsewhere in the year ahead. So as I said, most of the countries are already deeply negative. There's not much lower they can go, whereas the US can go much lower. And I think that will change. And I think that's relevant because the reason I called for a large 2018 bounce was that the massive rise in US real yields hadn't been priced, and the US was outperforming in growth. And while the US still might do better than many on growth this year, it's where the optimism, as I mentioned at the start, is still most misplaced. So I think that real yield benefit will get slashed in the year ahead, and the growth outlook will change a chunk. I think I should just mention again the secular argument of, you know, the US share of global GDP and trade is declining, and as will its share of global reserves, which are still over 61%, but slowly declining over time. These are both really long, slow, kind of long-term themes, but we are seeing them happen. And it's very hard to kind of trade these super long-term themes. They're important to have in mind, but you can't kind of trade them on a month-to-month basis. And I think on that note, like last time I mentioned that one of the problems with markets in 2018 was that traders were really struggling to price in several of these long-term themes, and they're trying to price them in too quickly. And that's why there was this kind of, we believe that 2018 would see higher volatility in 2017. 2019 seemed lower volatility again, but I think we're about to go back into that cycle where traders are going to realize, oh, wait a sec, some of these long-term themes, like the trade war, they're not going away. How do we price them in? And they try to price them in too quickly, and that's, you can't do it. They're going to ebb and flow over years. And I think another one is actually, I think we mentioned this before, is on tech stocks and the changing regulatory regime for tech stocks. Is one of those ones that's kind of suddenly come back into the news in the last week or so. Again, I think that's absolutely happening, but it's happening over many years, and it's not something you need to suddenly kind of sell all tech stocks because there's going to be more regulatory scrutiny, there's going to be more tax costs, more compliance costs, more legal costs. But it's something you need to be aware of, that it's going to be slowly shifting over time. And again, it's going to ebb and flow. The tech companies are going to get some victories. Some governments are going to get some victories, maybe France with their kind of tax there. So I think that these are long-term themes which traders really struggle to battle with. And I think that was the shift between 2017 and 2018. And I think, again, now we're about to go into that shift where people are going to realize some long-term themes are very, very important. But it's how do you work out how important they are right at this moment? And that's really hard.
Okay, so if the dollar is topping here, and we've also seen some pretty soft commodity prices, does that mean it's time to buy commodities?
This is Arden. Look, I got commodities very wrong this year. I kind of gloated of having got treasuries very right, so I'll admit I got commodities very wrong. I think that was mainly due to the shift in the trade war. They were soggier than I expected, particularly on the metal side. Look, that does validate the negative growth outlook, but I don't have particularly any strong views. I do think that the Iran-Middle East tension is underpriced as a tail risk in markets. Not that I'm saying anything is going to go wrong, but I think that people are underestimating how much of a shock that will be if there is military action which disrupts the Straits of Hormuz. There's no ability for other suppliers to fill the gap there if the Straits of Hormuz is blocked. So that will cause quite a big distortion in oil prices until that gets freed up. So that's a risk I think might be underpriced. I'm bullish gold, but silver even more so. Not short term, I've no particular view. Short term again, commodities. But as QE comes back in the agenda globally over the next year, then the gold bugs will come out in force. And ironically, when the gold bugs come out in force, that's when silver outperforms because it's the higher beta one. We saw this in the last crisis when the gold-silver cross lost more than half its value between late 2008 and early 2011. So unless deflation becomes the consensus fear, silver should keep outperforming gold over the next year. It's kind of like complementary but tangential to my bearish views, because if the world gets in a deep, deep crisis, this view won't actually work. But then the bearish equities view will then outperform even my expectations.
And let's talk about China since we're talking about trade wars. What's your outlook there?
That's another one I think I got wrong, but again, due to the trade war deterioration, it suffered more than I envisioned. I thought there was more weakness last year, but I kind of argued that the long-term fundamental picture was quite positive. It's obviously at the center of current problems, and my view there is definitely shifting. I think that, again, when I was in New York and talked to a lot of investors, it's very easy to focus on all the problems China has and maybe not focus on the problems in the US. And I think one of the things I will say is that they're more aware and priced in China than perhaps they are in the US at times. But China is definitely at the center of current problems. And those Germany and Singapore weaknesses that I spoke about at the start really speak to its problems. One thing I'll just say on China that, like, while I think my view is turning more negative, you know, last year I strongly dismissed the corporate debt concerns. And I think this has been a theme of the last few years. I'm always like, stop worrying about the corporate debt bubble. Yes, it's a massive corporate debt bubble, but this does not mean it needs to blow up anytime soon. And the PBOC has many tools. I find it really ironic that for the first time in many years, no one is overly concerned about China's debt problem this year, just as there are signs of problems. And there are a lot of signs of liquidity problems. You know, the Baosheng bank seizure really changed the game. It broke more links of trust. I think people have misunderstood the China credit problem. So there's not a lack of liquidity in the system. It's just the liquidity is not flowing to the people who really need it. And so up until the Baosheng bank seizure, it wasn't flowing to this kind of small, desperate private companies. And that was the link in the chain that's broken. But with the seizure of the Baosheng bank, what we're seeing is more links in the chain were kind of damaged, like into the small and medium-sized banks, into the kind of non-bank financial institutions. So suddenly more links in the chain are broken. There's more of a problem. So I will emphasize that I still don't think that the corporate debt bubble in China, and there is a debt bubble, blows up in the next 12 months, because I think, again, people underestimate the number of tools the PBOC has to fight it. But I think that it's ironic that for the first time ever, I think, there's people should have it as a very unlikely tail risk on their radar, and yet people are suddenly stopping to worry about it, which is a bit weird.
Let's move on to a couple of currencies. Boris Johnson taking over in the UK. What about the British pound?
The pound has got nothing good going for it. I've been a regular basher of the pound. Essentially, it still remains a sell and rallies. The fundamentals just remain terrible. It's one of those things, though, that it's just gone in a straight line for like 3 months, and there's a natural instinct to wonder when the pullback is due. But the problem is the fundamentals just keep on getting worse and worse. The collapse in the PMIs across the board recently, manufacturing, construction, and services, suggests that the country may be heading toward a recession. The current account outlook, which is the tail risk, continues to deteriorate. It's now, the consensus estimate on Bloomberg is now 4.3% of GDP for 2019. That consensus estimate was at 3.5% only 3 months ago. So the collapse in the currency is not alleviating that kind of key risk. And that's kind of reminiscent of an EM currency. And many people would say some of the times the politics has been reminiscent of an EM country as well recently. The UK is a leveraged economy. It's backed by a large and growing current account deficit. It's got deeply negative real yields, and it's got poor growth. I mean, none of this is good for a currency. The only thing I'll say that in Sterling's favor is that all of this is super well known. None of it is new. So surely at some point there'll be some type of relief rally. Just we get a minor bit of good news and it's like, you know, away, we've got some good news. Let's take some profit on our shorts. And that might be like a short-term powerful squeeze. But it's unlikely to be a turning point. And I think I will say that even though we've seen a lot of weakness in sterling, to me, the vulnerable side in sterling for the next kind of large gapping move is for further weakness again. Just I think, and if we do go to that no-deal hard Brexit, I do think we'll get another large down leg. That might be the bottom. But I think, unfortunately for sterling, even though everyone is bearish, even though there's likely to be the odd relief rally, the fundamentals just remain appalling and the currency is not weakened enough.
Let's touch on the Hong Kong dollar peg to the US dollar. Until very recently, I kind of thought, hey, it's really unquestionable that they've got a very well-designed system. Nothing can go wrong. But I think the political situation in Hong Kong right now is just really off the charts. So is there a risk of breaking the peg for the Hong Kong dollar? And what would the consequences and knock-on effects be if so?
I think the consequences would be massive. I think the political dynamics here with China at the moment are very important. I should emphasize, I'm really not concerned about the peg going still. I think obviously it's something that people need to be aware of, but I have just so little concern about this. And this is something we kind of talked about last year, and other people were super concerned, and people keep on being really concerned. But I think there's a couple of things that aren't understood in the situation. I think that's most importantly, the PBOC and its $3 trillion war chest stands behind the HKMA. So, you know, everyone kind of goes, oh, the HKMA only have, you know, $450 billion in reserves, which is still quite a lot. And many people analyze how many of them they can use in reality, etc. And I don't want to get into too details and argument about that because we could have a whole other podcast about that. And I've written lots about this before, kind of arguing with some other people about this. But essentially, the PBOC also stands behind them. And I think that's really important. So this is, you're basically taking on the most powerful other player in the whole kind of financial markets at the time when that other player also controls the rules of the game and can alter them easily. And I think people underestimate that. So it's not just kind of squeezing funding rates, which is their most obvious tool, but theoretically they could take much more direct intervention methods in the Hong Kong dollar market, such as, you know, for example, closing the Nostro accounts of those borrowing Hong Kong dollar to short it. So essentially, you know, I never ever want to take on someone who is way more powerful than me and controls all the rules of the game. And I think that's really important. And also their experience, the HKMA has dealt with peg situations or peg challenges in the past. This isn't a novel situation for them. So I think that experience is crucial. And you know, what's most interesting is Hong Kong reserves last month just hit a record high. There's no sign of attack. There's no sign of them needing to intervene. So I think it's, you know, it's funny that, like, you know, a lot of, particularly again in the US, there's very high profile attackers of the Hong Kong dollar. And as I always say, like, look, I'm completely unconcerned. But if I'm wrong, I'm going to get advance notice. Like, I can change my view in time. Like, if I suddenly see Hong Kong reserves start falling precipitously, well, then maybe I'll change my mind. But I just find it bizarre that people focus capital and effort and time attacking something which is nearly going to be impossible to break on their terms. And second of all, shows no sign of any kind of weakness. So yeah, I do not think it's a risk, but obviously the political situation there at the moment is worth watching. And in terms of consequences, it's absolutely massive if something does go wrong.
Well, Mark, I want to thank you for a fantastic interview. As always, you're just a fire hose of fascinating information. Before I let you go, though, please tell our listeners a little bit more about the Markets Live blog and how they can follow your work at Bloomberg.
Yep, sure. I think, unfortunately, for some of your listeners, most of my content is only available on the Bloomberg terminal. Most of that is on the Bloomberg Markets Live blog, as you mentioned, and that's MLIV Go. I also do a column, an NI Macro Review column, but ultimately it's all on the terminal or occasionally on Macro Voices podcast.
Well, you've got to love that, and we'll have you back again soon. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Mark Cudmore. But joining us now in the post game is former Dallas Fed advisor Danielle DiMartino Booth. Now, Danielle, I have to say, like, Powell surprised the markets in a big way with his statement that this is a mid-cycle adjustment. What's going on here? I mean, is this really a one and done? What's your take on what just happened in the last 48 hours?
Well, I remember when my former boss, Richard Fisher, said that we were in the late innings. And boy, did he get in trouble with that. On the other hand, because the economy was not in the late innings. But nobody can get Jay Powell in trouble for sticking his own foot in his mouth and putting the supposition out there that we're mid-cycle under the assumption that, what, we're going to have a 20-year economic expansion? So that really, really, really got things off on a bad foot at the beginning of the press conference. And then he actually managed to chase his tail at the podium and go back and forth, confusing markets. We were watching 200-point swings in the Dow while he was at the podium because he was giving out such contradictory signals to the market that the only thing that was apparent in the end was he didn't know what was going on.
Danielle, one of the other things that came up in this meeting was, and it doesn't seem to have gotten a lot of press attention, is they basically pulled the plug on what they call balance sheet reduction, which everybody else calls quantitative tightening. What's the significance of this, and what meaning should we ascribe to that particular policy move that nobody's really talking about?
Well, so this is a tacit admission. Because they would never call it quantitative easing, and they would also never call it quantitative tightening, because they wanted for people to look at these policies as being simply mechanistic in nature and easy to be wound up and just as easy to exit and wind them down. And it would be watching paint dry and put it on autopilot, but it was definitely not going to be a form of monetary tightening. Well, guess what? If it wasn't a form of monetary tightening, then they would have let it quantitative tightening conclude in September as originally planned. And instead, they pulled the plug at this latest meeting, which, again, they're saying, you know what? We were wrong. That is what the Fed said. We were wrong. It was indeed a form of tightening that at least gave the perception or exacerbated the situation of a dollar liquidity shortage.
Now, tell me if I'm exaggerating or reading too much into this, but Danielle, September is only a month away. Is this an admission that things were going so badly that they couldn't even stay the course for one more month on their balance sheet reduction before taking reaction to avert something going even more badly wrong? I mean, it seems to me like you don't pull the plug at just one month early unless you're really worried.
Well, not unless you listen to what else came out of the other side of his mouth, that we were mid-cycle. So again, it was a sea of contradictions because but before we had today's rebuttal, shall we say, from the White House, before we had today's rebuttal, the markets had begun to price out that September, the certainty of that September rate cut. So even though there was a little bit of upset in the markets, they're still close to all-time highs. Jay Powell may have actually put his head on the pillow the night of the meeting and said, you know what? There was very little collateral damage. The markets do not have September priced in as a certainty. I've had my cake. I'm eating it too. All is good until, of course, today.
Let's move on then to the White House reaction, because not only has President Trump said very publicly, you know, thank the Fed for this, you know, it's the stock market, it's the Fed's fault, the Fed let us down again. There's been some very strong rhetoric there. But I think what happened this afternoon is the trade war tweet about China got so much attention that most people missed another tweet from President Trump where he's retweeting a media interview with, I forget who the pundit was, but somebody who was calling to abolish the Federal Reserve completely. It wasn't Ron Paul. It was some other commentator on the abolish the Fed thing. So all of a sudden, the president of the United States is retweeting media interviews with people who favor abolishing the Fed. Is this just the president venting frustration, or is there a possibility that we're actually headed into a situation where the president of the United States seeks to eliminate or take away the power of the Federal Reserve as an independent central bank?
Well, so ask yourself this basic fundamental question. Can the president, after every time the Fed meets and does not satisfy what he wanted in terms of additional easing, like that that he feels his peers are getting in Europe and in China, does the president have the ability to, excuse the pun, trump out a fresh set of tariffs after every Fed meeting that dissatisfies him? No. So he has to up the ante. He has to say, you know what, if you continue to defy my will, which is what the Fed, by the way, is obligated to do. The Fed is obligated to be independent. If you continue to defy my will, then I'm just going to take away your independence. And it's not, there's no sure thing. There's no shoe in at all. There has to be a few rational lawmakers left in Congress. I could probably count them on two hands. It wouldn't be a shoe-in, but boy, would it upset the global financial system because of the way that we are the world's leading central bank. We drive the train. And what if we tell the rest of the world the train is driving blind, we've fired the conductor?
Well, I really want to pick up on that, and particularly what it would mean in terms of the rest of the world's commitment to the U.S. dollar as the world's global reserve currency. Let's suppose, for sake of argument, that lawmakers would ultimately not allow President Trump to actually abolish the Fed so there is no more central bank in the United States. Let's assume that we're not going to get all the way to that outcome. But we do go through a process where President Trump is very publicly and visibly, seemingly trying to cause that outcome to occur. It seems to me like if I put myself in Mario Draghi or Kuroda-san's shoes, my confidence in continuing to rely on the U.S. dollar as the world's global reserve currency when the head of state is trying to abolish its independent central bank, that just doesn't add up for me. What do you think the consequences and implications could be?
So you're describing a very logical potential progression. And that is that if confidence is shaken to a significant enough extent that you have some other major players in the world economy begin to contemplate more than they already are. We know that the dollar as in terms of its position in world trade has declined over the past few years since China has risen up. I'm not saying that the Chinese currency has in any way displaced the dollar, but dollar transactions have indeed gone to other currencies as countries contemplate our runaway deficits and debt. But what if such a move on the part of the White House was to amplify and expedite those contemplations such that the IMF or other global entities were to get involved to say, okay, we need to come up with a doomsday plan in the event that this actually happens. So think about that, because we're already on a slippery slope because we've used the greenback as a weapon of mass destruction towards our even our allies. So you don't want global powers that be sitting around big tables in conference rooms contemplating how and what they would do in a post-dollar reserve currency world, just in case the man over in that White House succeeds.
Danielle, let's follow this through. One of the things that a lot of people have said is, look, even if various people, because of concerns about the U.S., in the opinion of some people, overstepping its authority in telling other countries what to do, particularly with respect to Iran sanctions, what people have said is, look, don't worry about the U.S. dollar and whether it's going to be the global reserve currency for one simple reason, which is there is no viable alternative to the U.S. Treasury bond market for central bank reserve assets, because there's no other bond market in the world with the depth and liquidity needed to absorb central bank-sized capital flows. Given that that's kind of the widely accepted view, what actions would central bankers contemplate if suddenly the president of the United States, on one hand, you've got no replacement for the U.S. Treasury market, but on the other hand, if the U.S. Treasury market has a certain characteristics of stability and volatility based on having a central bank, and the president of the United States is trying to abolish the central bank, what options would be available to foreign central banks, and what would they do in terms of their reserve assets? What could it mean for U.S. Treasury holdings abroad?
Well, I think that a potential interim agreement could be forged among the other countries who would have a potentially partially viable currency. I don't mean to be talking in circles, but I'm just saying that the euro can't stand on its own, the yuan can't stand on its own, and the yen can't stand on its own. But what if the other three most traded currencies, plus let's throw the British pound sterling in for good reason, even though I'm getting ready to schedule my trip to London, the sterling's so weak. But let's just say you have four alternative currencies form a basket, and you have the blessing of the IMF because of the one-off and, you know, what they might consider to be craziness coming out of the United States, whereas we are supposed to be a harbor of stability for the world's financial system backed by a stable U.S. dollar.
It seems to me that this sets the stage. We know that politicians always want to have a big win when they first take over a new position. Christine Lagarde has strong ties in the IMF, obviously, and she's about to take over the ECB. It seems to me like a big win for her could be to take the helm of the ECB and say, look, we need a turbocharged SDR. We need to re-architect what the SDR is. And, oh, by the way, I had my team start working on this before I even left. And now that I'm head of the ECB, I want to talk to the BOJ and other major central banks about moving from the U.S. dollar to a new form of IMF SDR. Is that a logical progression? And what would be some of the pros and cons of that approach if it were to occur?
Well, look, it is certainly not impossible. I think it is not without some deep forethought that Lagarde is going to take on the helm of the ECB because she is a political animal and she does understand negotiations and she is so deeply respected on the global stage and has negotiated and dealt with every male and female major leader that you can name. So there is something to be said for having a unifying individual who could potentially try and bridge all of the other countries' anxieties, because that is what is building on the world stage. Right now we have, when things like throwing tariffs out there willy-nilly that throw crude oil prices worldwide down 8%, hurting other countries that are oil-producing nations. When you have moves that produce such extreme levels of volatility, you could almost make the argument that you would need to have somebody come in and contemplate and lead an alternative type of regime, or at least bring together, I don't know, whatever bureaucrats bring together, a very expensive study group.
So Danielle, it appears that the market is all of a sudden pricing in Europe that there's going to be a rate cut before Christine even comes into power. Like, what's going on over there?
So I think that it was Mario Draghi's dream to be able to get back to Rome and save face and not actually have to do, as I said, that he would do in Brussels 2 years ago, and that is lower negative interest rates further into negative territory, never normalizing monetary policy. But as soon as the Fed reduced rates by a quarter percentage point, the probability of a September the 12th European Central Bank rate cut shot up to 92%. He's not going to be able to defy that level of market certitude, on top of the fact that after this new tariff barb was thrown out there on the part of the United States, here back here domestically, probabilities of a September 18th, the Fed meets 6 days later, of a September 18th rate cut also shot up to being an almost sure thing.
And so with the market now pricing in September as a greater probability here, how does this work out? I mean, Powell's setting himself up. At least he gave the impression that this could be a one and done, but clearly the market doesn't think so. How does this play out here in the September meeting?
Well, so I think what makes the bad situation worse, there were stocks such as Abercrombie and Gap, some of the weaker links in the retail brick and mortar space that were trading down huge today after these tariff announcements. They're not going to have the financial wherewithal to do the panic buying ahead of September 1 implementation of higher tariffs. So Jay Powell is not only going to be quarreling with a market that is fully priced in the next rate cut, but one that is pricing in what he expressly wants to avoid and what he tried to communicate at this latest press conference, and that this is not the beginning of a rate easing cycle. We've already got the manufacturing sector in this country on its knees. It looks like we've just twisted the knife that's already in the heart of brick and mortar retail. So if you start to add up the industry sectors, including transportation, we saw transportation layoffs spike in the latest Challenger Grey and Christmas data. If you start to add it up, this latest move on the part of Trump could push the United States that much closer to recession, such that when they're sitting around the table on September the 17th and 18th, shameless plug, September the 17th is my birthday. But when they're sitting around the table on my birthday, they're going to have to be contemplating what the rate easing cycle looks like. Even though they have so little ammunition, they'll have 1.75 percentage points after the rate cut that is fully priced in on September the 18th. Wouldn't we all like to be a fly on that wall?
Danielle, we're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time. But before we let you go, I want to take this opportunity to announce a project that we're really excited about here at Macro Voices, which is for our August break to give our staff a little bit of time off. We're going to have a pre-recorded 2-week summer special. It'll be 2 episodes in a row that will be dedicated to Danielle DiMartino Booth and Peter Bookvar getting into a big discussion about everything from negative interest rates to modern monetary policy to socialism to the rise of populism and so on and so forth. Danielle, why Peter Bookvar and what do you guys have planned for us? Give our listeners a little taste of what they can expect.
Peter has always been an inflationista, and I have for many years been a deflationista. But when it comes to our criticism of modern monetary theory, when it comes to our criticism of central bankers taking us down this rabbit hole, we have a lot of rich and wonderful areas of agreement. And I think just hearing Danielle and Peter talk, because we talk every single day, will give people such deep insights into people who've been working together. Even while I was at the Federal Reserve for a decade, he was one of my advisors as I was an advisor at the Fed. Just to hear how the thinking comes together will be such a tremendous opportunity, I think, for all of your listeners.
We're really looking forward to that. And listeners, you can expect those 2 episodes to air on August 22nd and 29th. So that's coming up. And of course, Danielle will be back for All-Stars appearances on our regularly recurring schedule. We're going to need to leave it there. Today's episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Top Traders Unplugged. Don't forget to go to toptradersunplugged.com/macro to claim your free copy of The Many Flavors of Trend Following and subscribe to their podcast as well. You'll be glad you did. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. And folks, don't forget to visit macrovoices.com to register your free account. The benefit to you is you'll receive our free research roundup email every week, which contains a compendium of links to all of the best content that we could find on the internet, including downloads associated with our feature interviews. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's research roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to some of Mark Cudmore's recent articles. There's also an interesting piece for talking about OPEC's oil production dropping to 8-year lows, as well as an interesting article that the Fed might not cut more than once. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email,
containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.